This week on the Best of Flashpoints, an in-depth report on the multiple massacres in Indian-administered Gujarat with one of the key witnesses at a recent international hearing. Also, Flashpoint's special correspondent Dar Jamail unmasks Obama's pro-war policies in the Middle East. Anti-war activist and former Marine Adam Kokesh illegally spied on and physically confronted by the FBI. And the Knight Report. Dennis Bernstein, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Robert Knight are coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And now from exile in New York City, the Knight Report with Robert Knight.
In today's Knight Report and War Summary, the White House discards a sofa in Iraq, Obama misreads the surge, and McCain gets lost along a non-existent border. I'm Robert Knight in New York. In Iraq today, the White House gave up the ghost for a sofa or status of forces agreement by July 31st, settling instead for an undisclosed executive agreement between President Bush and Iraqi puppet Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. White House spokesperson Dana Perino tried to put the best light on nationalist resistance to the U.S. proposed terms that would obviate Iraqi law and sovereignty with her words, quote, "I don't think that we'll be able to finalize this agreement by next Thursday. We're working toward it, but it might take a few more days after that," end quote. There was also a proposal in Iraq today, but no real progress on an election law that would have advanced the Kurdish partition by allowing a vote on embedding the ethnically mixed and oil-rich city of Kirkuk into the semi-autonomous Kurdistan regime, rather than Baghdad's pseudo-federal green zone occupation regime. Earlier today, the parliament passed a provincial polling law that included representational guarantees for Arabs and Turkmen who also inhabit the city of Kirkuk. But Kurdish members walked out in hopes of claiming the wealthy oil refinery town for the Kurdish enclave, leaving doubt that the proposal would be approved by President Jalal Talabani, himself a Kurd. Also in Iraq, Barack Obama continued his international campaign, saying that he's so far sticking to a 16-month withdrawal plan for U.S. combat troops in Iraq, even though that would still leave as much as one-third of the 150,000 so-called advisory troops still there, along with 100,000 more U.S. mercenaries and private contractors. Obama accredited the illusory dip in daily violence in Iraq to the so-called surge, which added 30,000 to 40,000 more troops late last year. Obama said he did not anticipate, quote, "the convergence of not only the surge, but the Sunni awakening in which a whole host of Sunni tribal leaders decided they had had enough with al-Qaeda," end quote. Obama gave no hint that he was aware of the fact that the fighting in Iraq diminished mostly because Muqtada al-Sadr called a ceasefire last year for his Mahdi army, because the U.S. troops assisted puppet Prime Minister Maliki in ethnic cleansing and the elimination of his militia rivals, because Iran supported a quiet period for Shia militancy in Iraq, because British troops left their hotly assaulted bases in Basra and southern Iraq, and because Sunni insurgents took some time off to accept tens of millions of dollars from the U.S. to be paid not to fight. Nevertheless, Obama chirped that, quote, "what you had was a combination of political factors inside of Iraq that then came right at the same time, as well as terrific work by our troops," end quote. And finally, Obama's Republican opponent, John McCain, meanwhile pulled a Reagan, emulating his hero's lack of grasp of geographic reality, such as when Reagan once toasted the people of Bolivia during a state visit to Brazil. In McCain's case, he forgot about the existence of Iran, that nation he once wanted to bomb, when he erroneously claimed on Fox TV that Iraq borders the next nation over, which, according to McCain, is not Iran, but Pakistan.
We have a lot of work to do, and I'm afraid that it's a very hard struggle, particularly given the situation on the Iraq-Pakistan border. And I would not announce that I'm going to attack Pakistan.
Senator John McCain, somewhere on the non-existent Iraqi-Pakistani border. From exile in New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
And in Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Thank you so much, Robert Knight, for that excellent report. Today, we go back to a very difficult story. On July 16, 2008, in a historic first-time hearing on the multiple massacres in Indian-administered Kashmir, the European Parliament convened a meeting in Brussels, Belgium. A key witness at that hearing was Dr. Angana Chatterjee, co-convener of the International People's Tribunal on Human Rights and Justice in Kashmir. At the hearing, Dr. Chatterjee offered detailed testimony of the gravity of the human rights situation in Kashmir in the present moment. She described the tribunal's investigation of nearly 800 mass graves in June of 2008 and showed video clips of mass graves from Baramulla and Kupwara districts. Dr. Chatterjee described the continued militarization and impunity with which the military and paramilitary forces function in Kashmir. She also spoke to the investigators about disappearances, torture, sexual violence, a very extraordinary situation. I'm proud to say that Dr. Chatterjee is based in the Bay Area, a good friend of the show, and a hero of mine for the courageous work she shows and does in the face of endless threats and the constant pressure being put on her to shut her mouth and stay inside the university. By the way, that is the California Institute of Integral Studies, where Dr. Chatterjee is an associate professor of social and cultural anthropology. Dr. Chatterjee, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Dennis, always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for having me.
We had promised the audience and everybody that we were going to have you on yesterday, but we're in the middle of a breaking story. I know you're deeply engaged in the tribunal and in the testimony and the aftermath of the testimony that took place on July 16th. And I do note that on July 10th, the European Parliament adopted an urgent resolution based on information from Amnesty International. So maybe as a way of bringing in the beginner, you can remind people exactly what we're talking about.
Yes.
When we allude to massacres, and then why the EP, the European Parliament, took emergency action.
Absolutely. We're talking about Indian-administered Kashmir, and there since 1989, that is nearly two decades of genocidal violence have taken place, that record over 70,000 people killed, 8,000 people disappeared, 60,000 people tortured, 50,000 children orphaned, and these are conservative numbers, and an incalculable sexualized and gendered violence. I was speaking with the psychiatrist in the only psychiatric facility in Kashmir, which is in Srinagar, and he was telling me that last year 68,000 patients went there, and that Kashmir itself, according to his findings, has a very high rate of people with suicidal behaviors. There are hundreds of thousands of people displaced. There are violations of promises, laws, conventions, agreements, treaties. There's mile after mile of barbed wire, and supposedly we are in a post-conflict era. I also want to talk about the daunting presence of military and paramilitary forces, increased and sophisticated surveillance, where police, certain adjunct of police forces functioned as the military, and a presence of almost 500,000 troops at any given point of time in a region that is a nuclear flashpoint.
Tell us about the investigation of the mass graves, what you found, and who you suspect are the perpetrators.
Yes. As you know, we started the International People's Tribunal on Human Rights and Justice in Indian-administered Kashmir this April. And in June, my colleague, Advocate Pervez Imroz, who's a co-convener with me of the tribunal, and myself, along with staff and camera crew, went to two districts. One, which is one of the most heavily militarized in the region, Kupwara district, and we went to look at 748 graves. This is in addition to 500 other graves that had already been identified by our collective in the month of late March, early April. And what we found was on hillsides, in flatland, over the last 20 years, these graves exist. The ghosts in them are disquiet. These graves exist of military and paramilitary terror. These graves have been constructed on village land. They are often unmarked and unknown. They are in masses. Sometimes one grave contains more than one body. And these exist to conceal the massacre perpetrated by military and paramilitary forces in Kashmir. The bodies are brought largely by the police, sometimes at night. Sometimes the bodies have been tortured or burnt or desecrated, and they are given to villagers and asked that the villagers bury them. Villagers have not been able to resist that on two counts. One is that they are afraid of what the police and military and paramilitary might do to them. And secondly, they kept telling me repeatedly that they see it as their obligation, as duty to these people that have died nameless, unmarked, uncared for. So they take them on and they tell me that this becomes their commitment to freedom. In the graves that we went, one as recently as that very week that had been brought in, they are row upon rows of them, some in rubble, some marked by communities. We met with a gravedigger who tells me that he hasn't slept for years between 2002 and 2006 when he was asked to bury these bodies. This is a man nearing 70, and he has nightmares every night. And he says that, you know, sister, it's like a role in my head, a reel that plays itself out over and over again of all these bodies. The police record, we have been given to understand that they photographed these bodies before death. And once our investigations came to light, forces in Kashmir have claimed that these are all militant bodies. And two arguments I have to that. Even if they are militant, and they're often identified as foreign militants, which means from across the border, Pakistan, etc., in war, there are rules of conduct. The police should make available the photographs so people can identify their bodies and families grieve. But secondly, here's the more disturbing fact. In a majority of instances where bodies have been identified, first, the process of identification has been harrowing for families. And where they have been identified, in a majority of instances, we find that not only are these not foreign militants, they are not even local militants from Kashmir. They are ordinary citizens, often killed in fake encounters.
I just want to ask you to say a little bit about who's who. Is this a religious war? Is this a colonial war? Who is killing who? Who is controlling who? Is this about religion or about resources?
I think it is about the brutalization that has become normal conduct on part of every nation state. And in India, which is an emergent superpower, its military and paramilitary forces have unleashed incalculable terror since 1990, first to subjugate what was then a peaceable movement for self-determination. The movement for self-determination in Kashmir, Kashmir disagreed in 1947 when India and Pakistan attained their freedom from Britain. Kashmir disagreed that it should be a part of India. There have been three wars fought in the region. Part of Kashmir is today held by Pakistan, so it is Pakistan administered, and part of it is Indian administered. And between 1946 and 1990, largely the movement for self-determination was nonviolent. Disproportionate terror in quelling this on part of the Indian state and quelling this movement for self-determination led to militancy in the area. But today I want to state a record that then counter-brutalization on part of the state, you know, the cycles of repression, state violence, group violence, counter-state violence, has led to the militancy, according to the Indian government's own statistics today, being very low. The Indian government statistics state that there are between 450 to 500 militants in Kashmir. At the same time, we have an army of 500,000 soldiers. So what is it that we are guarding? The Indian state is clearly not needing 500,000 soldiers to guard 450 militants. So it leads us to conclude that the movement for self-determination, for people to determine their future, which does not mean that they wish to go to Pakistan, that they wish to leave India, or it does not neither mean that they do not wish to become an independent state. It means all of these things. And that movement continues in Kashmir at the heart of every home every day, and it is largely to subjugate people's right to determine their future that the Indian armed presence continues in Kashmir, because largely resolution of Kashmir has become a game between New Delhi and Islamabad. Rarely do you hear Kashmiris present, rarely do you see Kashmiris present or hear Kashmir as a stakeholder in what has become a conflict between New Delhi and Islamabad, known as Kashmir.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Dr. Angana Chatterjee. We're talking about the massacres that took place in Gujarat and other parts of the country. I think you need to spend a minute or two talking about the level of the violence and the specific targeting of women.
Absolutely. I think the level of violence is twofold. It's manifold, actually. There is the obvious violence of guns and of the militarization. There is also the violence of people regulating their own behavior, of people quietly having retreated. I have made 8 trips to Indian-administered Kashmir between July 2006 and June-July of 2008. I just returned, it's less than 3 weeks since I came back from there. And repeatedly people have talked about the protracted isolation in which there is the impossibility of even acknowledging what has been ongoing in their lives. And the violence seems geared to not the militancy, which today has largely abetted local militancy and also cross-border militancy, but it seems largely geared to domesticating the Kashmiri subject from their a desire for participation to determine the future. And that's what the Indian state does not wish to. It wishes to see the Kashmir issue as resolved. And it claims it to be either low conflict or post-conflict right now. The violence, particularly against women, there is a category in Kashmir which is heartbreaking. It is these people known as half-widows, whose husbands have been disappeared, and they do not count. They are not recipients of any state aid, for example, and socially they are often ostracized. As you know, that in any conflict or most conflict situations, intense violence also fuels intense conservatism in part. The sexualized violence that has taken place, rapes of women and gang rapes of women by both the military and in certain instances by the militancy. There is very little space in which to discuss that. Also the gendered and sexualized violence when former militants, for example, have been captured by the state. And I have spoken with these former militants. Some of them are now peace activists. The torture that they were subjected to when they were in custody, I met with a man who was, for example, had been hung upside down and had petrol injected into his anus. Waterboarding is extremely common. Mutilation takes place. Rape of children has taken place, along with, of course, women and men, starvation and psychological torture. Sometimes when people have been tortured, they've been healed to be brutalized again. And this woman was asked to, and man and woman were asked to witness the rape of their daughter, and the mother pleaded and said, you know, I cannot do that. Please don't make me do that. Let me take me out of the room or kill me. The soldier pointed a gun to her forehead, stating that he would grant her wish, and shot her before they proceeded to rape the daughter. The low-intensity war continues. In March of 2007, 3 Indian government committees on demilitarization resolved this and placed in limbo troop reduction and the repealment of draconian laws, such as the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, such as the Disturbed Areas Act, and the Public Safety Act, all of which allows for the state forces to control the general population with impunity.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Dr. Angana Chatterjee, and we're talking about a very difficult situation. As we reported in the opening, on July 16th, the European Parliament convened a meeting, an investigation into the Indian-administered Kashmir, and to look into these killings, these massacres that have been reported and that you've been working on, Dr. Chatterjee. Tell us about what happened there.
My colleague Pervez Imroz, prolific human rights lawyer, he cannot leave the country and has had 2, now 3 assassination attempts on his life. And Pervez Imroz and I had gone together to investigate these mass graves in Baramulla and Kupwara district. And the first day we went and we came back. The next day I interviewed torture victims. And the third day when we headed out, we had a huge number of people follow us, intelligence officers, and we understand that the orders came from the highest authorities. They interrupted our work. They interrogated us. They forcibly got into our car and ordered us to the police station. They asked to seize our tapes. We resisted. I, for example, had three cars with security personnel following me. In this climate of intimidation, we went into the heart of the old city and collected testimonials from two families whose sons earlier that week, this is I'm talking about June 30th this year, earlier that week had been killed by state forces. And we collected testimonials, and I went back to my hotel, and Pervez Imroz, who lives slightly outside Srinagar, went back to his home. And that night, neighbors described these people to be belonging to state forces in uniform. There was an attack on Pervez Imroz's house.
This is the attorney, the human rights attorney.
Yes. The next day, we went to the police station to file what is known as a first information report, and we were joined by the tribunal's legal counsel, a Supreme Court of India lawyer, Mihir Desai, and we were not allowed to file a first information report. And imagine if this is how they're denying us, what happens to ordinary citizens when they actually get together the courage to chance into a police station.
Well, let me say something, Dr. Chatterjee, as an aside. We have talked about this before, and of course we are greatly appreciative of your willingness to be our special correspondent, if you will, on this important story. But I tell you, we do a lot of controversial stories and get a lot of threats and a lot of frightening stuff. But every time I have you on, the attacks on you and me are absolutely terrifying, and they sound something like, "Dear sir, I'm not even going to address you as a person because you're an animal, and you had that animal on your show." And the level of intensity just here on a radio show is extraordinary. So it's hard to imagine the gravity of the attacks and how difficult it is to do this kind of investigation.
Yes, I'm very appreciative always of your solidarity, and you're bringing this up. My father was a freedom fighter for India's independence, and he used to keep saying that the role of the public intellectual is to use your faculties, your intelligence, and your care and your rigor to speak up. So I must continue to do this. And then when I was leaving Kashmir and then finally India to come back to the to San Francisco, I received an anonymous call. I'm now being stopped at immigration and harassed and questioned. But I received a phone call that said, "Madam, we know you're leaving. Think wisely before coming back." And I'm a citizen of India and a permanent resident of the United States. And if this is the climate in which the world's largest democracy is functioning, whether it is state forces, whether it is people who consider the rights of those that are not part of the majority community to be irrelevant to the nation state, I can only see a future of greater sadness and violence. Everyday life shrinks. It's unspoken, the terror that they live out. And it's amazing to me the care and kindness and rigor and diligence and ethics and commitment to nonviolence that I have found amongst my colleagues.
Just say something about what it means to have the parliament looking into this.
Yes.
And where this investigation goes now.
Okay. The parliament passed a resolution based on our coalition's report on mass graves, and it also passed a resolution asking that mass graves be investigated by the government of India, an impartial investigation into them, and that human rights defenders such as Pervez Imroz, such as all of us working in the tribunal, be protected. It is our hope, it is my sincere hope, that the government of India does not see this as something that it needs to run away and hide from, because you can't hide from this level of violence, but that we understand that to heal requires accepting accountability, and that accepting responsibility, making reparations, stopping the regularized violence in Kashmir and permitting people, civil society, to participate in discussions of their future is absolutely crucial for security, peace, and justice in the region.
What do you say, Dr. Chatterjee, when people say, you know, why don't you just stay in the classroom and do what you're supposed to do?
I think that the classroom is about thinking, right? Thinking is learning to fly. And thinking requires that we are resident in the world. And knowledge that seeks to take an advocacy position is perhaps the most difficult to undertake. And I think that we should all support each other in academic practice that brings the world closer to us, not pushes it away.
That is the voice of Dr. Angana Chatterjee. She is the co-convener of the International People's Tribunal on Human Rights and Justice in Kashmir. She is a teacher, a professor, associate professor of social and cultural anthropology at California Institute of Integral Studies. She's a friend of this show. We have the greatest respect for you, Dr. Chatterjee. We urge you to be very, very careful and to keep us posted. We want to go right along with you and cover this story as best we can.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein, and I commend you for your work and for this show.
Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, was inside Iraq's Al-Anbar province earlier today before moving on to Amman, Jordan, and speaking with that country's leader, King Abdullah. While in Iraq, Obama met with U.S.-installed Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and President Jalal Talabani and reportedly talked about the security situation in U.S.-occupied Iraq. Al Jazeera reports that Obama, speaking at a press conference in Amman, quote, reiterated his belief that Afghanistan should be the central front of the U.S.'s so-called war on terror, emphasizing that the security situation in Iraq had improved and welcoming the growing consensus in the United States and Iraq for a timeline for withdrawal, probably in 2010. Joining us to talk about what this means is our special correspondent, Dar Jamail. Dar is the award-winning author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. Dar, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Good to be with you, Nora.
So talk about your reaction to Barack Obama meeting with U.S.-installed Iraqi leaders and once again stating his staunch support of the Israeli government.
Obama is the fearless leader now of the mainstream Democratic Party, which is basically Team B in the war and imperial agenda of this country. Anyone who hasn't woken up to the fact that we're living in the middle of an empire needs to start doing some reading. Barack Obama, it's interesting that he's continuously getting this pass from the media and especially from the left and the so-called anti-war left in this country, because if I had a chance to ask him a couple of questions, for example, if I was in one of these press conferences that he's holding in places like Baghdad and in Amman, I would be asking him, Mr. Obama, Senator Obama, what do you have to say about the U.S. military document Joint Vision 2020? Because this is a document, along with a couple of others, that are really key when we talk about U.S. foreign policy and if there really will be troop withdrawal from Iraq and when that might happen. Because if you read Joint Vision 2020, let me quote from it. I have a copy of it right here in front of me. The vision in this document is, quote, dedicated individuals and innovative organizations transforming the joint force of the 21st century to achieve full spectrum dominance. That means using the U.S. military to dominate the globe, having total control of air, land, and sea, but also information and space, And then the document goes on to read, persuasive in peace, decisive in war, preeminent in any form of conflict. And in that document alone, the term full-spectrum dominance is used over 13 times. I would say, Senator Obama, what are you doing to change that? Why won't you talk about troop withdrawal? Well, I think first you need to talk about changing documents like Joint Vision 2020 that drive U.S. foreign policy. Then I would simply ask him, what are you going to do to change the Quadrennial Defense Review Report? Because it's in this document where there's a stated ability for the U.S. military to fight, quote, multiple overlapping wars, as they're doing now, perhaps getting ready to add a third, and to, quote, ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. Now, when we have documents like this driving U.S. foreign policy, it should not come as a surprise to anyone why Barack Obama's advisors are calling for at least 90,000 troops to remain in Iraq until at least 2013, which is the end of his first term if he wins the race for the presidency. So why is he not being asked these questions? Why is he continuously being given these passes of, well, yeah, we're going to start pulling out troops and pull out combat troops by 2010, yada, yada, yada. Let's talk about these documents and ask him, what are you doing about total, complete, unconditional withdrawal of all U.S. forces and security contractors from that country?
Dar, Obama also met with the U.S.-backed Awakening Councils movement. Can you talk a little bit about why that meeting took place and what the strategy is there?
The Awakening Councils, they're called the Sahwa in Iraq, or the Sons of Iraq. There's lots of different names for them. I prefer the military's name for them, Concern Local Citizens. This is basically a 80,000-strong U.S.-funded militia. Most of the people in it, according to the U.S. military, are former resistance fighters, and many of them are even al-Qaeda members. All of them are being paid an average of $300 per month of U.S. taxpayer money. So it's kind of interesting that we have resistance fighters and some al-Qaeda members, according to the U.S. military, on the U.S. payroll. Very interesting type of policy. And it's interesting that Mr. Barack Obama is meeting with the leaders of these tribes that are in control of much of these Sahwa groups. And they're basically a stooge militia. They're backing them and standing them up against government security forces. There are actually clashes to some level or another just about every day in different parts of Iraq between these Sunni militia groups the U.S. is standing up and government security forces. It's really a chaotic, multi-layered, highly complex, disastrous policy where the U.S. is on one hand basically politically supporting their puppet government in Baghdad while simultaneously militarily supporting a very huge Sunni militia that's now posing a threat to the security forces of that government that they're supporting in Baghdad.
And Dar, could you talk about your assessment of what Barack Obama means when he says that Afghanistan should be the, quote, central front of the U.S.'s so-called war on terror?
Well, I don't think really Barack Obama knows specifically what he's talking about. If he's talking about pulling some troops out of Iraq and sending them into Afghanistan, he's not listening to military commanders. Nobody wants occupation forces in their country. We have two ongoing illegal occupations, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. Both of these are unsustainable. Both of them will end. There's resistance to both of these occupations in each country. And to think that you can basically rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic and take some troops from Iraq and put them in Afghanistan and basically make this the central front on the war on terror, whatever that is, a war against a word, basically, rather than a really clearly defined enemy with some ways to measure progress in that war. He's taking up the rhetoric that was created by the Bush administration in the wake of September 11, 2001. And Barack Obama, rather than showing himself to really be the candidate for real change, using this kind of rhetoric, how is that going to change the direction of this country? How is that going to change U.S. foreign policy? How is that going to stop and change this country from being an empire that, whose goal is dominating the globe and the world's resources? Instead, he's talking about, well, instead of highlighting Iraq as the front lines of the war on terror, we're going to use Afghanistan. If that's his idea of change, I think that sends a really clear message to anyone that's supporting this guy. If you're going to vote for him, you're basically voting for a continuation of the U.S. empire project, which is doomed.
And finally, Dar Jamil, he's in Amman, Jordan right now. The majority of the people in that country are refugees, either from Iraq or from Palestine over the last 60 years. And he took that opportunity to address the public and say that he would, quote, always support Israel in confronting terrorism. When Palestinians are being ethnically cleansed at an accelerated rate, when Iraq is in shambles, when Afghanistan is just a mess. What can you say about that?
Well, it's very clear who is pulling Barack Obama's strings. And I mean, it was evident to us before he got the nomination to be the Democratic presidential candidate. The second he got that, he basically fell over himself running over to AIPAC to give one of the most right-wing speeches that group has heard in a long time. So it's very clear who he is allied with, who is backing him, what his agenda is. And it's basically this ongoing, continued unbridled support of the state of Israel and their daily violations of international law in the occupied territories of Palestine, and what they do to people there that report on the truth. You and I, Nora, know personally Mohammed Omer, the individual who won the Martha Gellhorn Prize this year. We were co-recipients. And he, going back into his home country through Israeli-controlled borders, was tortured by the Shin Bet for many, many hours, and basically then taken back home in the back of an ambulance and spent many days in the hospital and is still recovering from being horrifically tortured simply because he was doing his job as a journalist and talking about what the Israeli military is doing in that country. This is a war crime. This is basically behavior akin to stormtroopers in Nazi Germany, where they made him strip, they tortured him, they made him pass out, they continued to do things to his body after he was passed out. That is the type of government that Barack Obama is supporting. Another thing I want to close with is I've often been accused in my talks of you're being a single issue voter. You're saying Obama and McCain are no different in Iraq. Barack Obama actually does have a little bit different policy, and certainly domestically has a different policy than John McCain. Well, I want to be really clear. I'm not a single issue voter. I'm a 1.2 million issue voter, because there's been at least 1.2 million Iraqis killed as a direct result of this invasion and occupation. We need justice for this. People like John McCain and Barack Obama are bound to be responsible for its continuation. And as that number climbs daily of dead Iraqis and dead and wounded American troops, until we have people that are willing to stand up and bring these people to account and make them answer directly, what are you going to do about unbridled support of the state of Israel as they're daily committing war crimes in Palestine? Until they're consistently confronted and forced to answer these questions, I think it's naive to think that there's going to be any real change in U.S. foreign policy regarding Israel or Iraq or Afghanistan or Iran. And it really doesn't matter whether we have a Barack Obama or John McCain sitting as the next president of this country.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of our special correspondent and dear friend, Dar Jamil. He is the author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. You can go to his website at www.dar.org for his reports. Thank you so much, Dar, again, for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora.
Johnny is marching home again. When Johnny is marching home again. When Johnny is marching home again, we'll all go out and welcome him. Never mind the shape he's in. And we'll ask him how the fighting went. We'll ask him how the fighting went. We'll ask him how the fighting went and how he liked the president. Casualties are an accident. And we'll beat our drums and wave our flags. We'll beat our drums and wave our flags. We'll beat our drums and wave our flags with great and grand and glorious rags. The ones they put on the body bags. Later on when the sickness comes. Later on when the sickness comes. Later on when the sickness comes, some chemicals and uranium. We'll wring our hands and we'll all play dumb.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The Baltimore Sun and other newspapers are reporting that undercover Maryland State Police officers repeatedly spied on peace activists and anti-death penalty groups in recent years and entered the names of some of them in a law enforcement database of people thought to be terrorists or drug traffickers. Newly released documents show a little bit more about the files. The files made public yesterday, the end of last week, by the Civil Liberties Union of Maryland, depict a pattern of infiltration of the activist organizations between 2005 and 2006. One of those who was spied on is Adam Kokesh. You have heard him on these airwaves. He is a former Marine. He's on the board of Iraq Vets Against the War. He works with Vets for Peace. And Adam Kokesh, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Just before we get into the spying, remind people some of the kinds of anti-war activities you've been involved in and some of the other encounters you've already had with the authorities.
Well, I joined Iraq Veterans Against the War in February of last year, and since then I've been arrested 6 times for my activism, some petty civil resistance, symbolic acts, some pretty clear-cut cases of political harassment, and of course never prosecuted successfully for any of those, never convicted. And, I've been, I guess you could say, in contact with law enforcement in various forms since then. Most notably, at Fort Benning last year on the bus tour, I got arrested for walking up to the gate with a bus behind me, not even wearing a T-shirt like the guys that went before me who got arrested were doing, wearing T-shirts that said Iraq Veterans Against the War. I've been working to support war resistors, to do truth in recruiting, to inspire a generation of young Americans to find a better way to serve their country than dying for empire. I've been an outspoken libertarian anarchist, and most recently I've been working with Veterans for Peace for impeachment, pressing Congressman Conyers about that. And, it's always an uphill battle, but it's just gotten a lot worse, you could say.
And you've been, let's say, handled fairly roughly by various authorities. Did you ever get beaten up or pushed around?
Not quite. The worst physical abuse I've received, I guess you could say, is on September 15th when we had 200 people arrested at the die-in in front of the Capitol for the anti-war march there. I jumped up on a wall to address the crowd, and a group of police in riot gear grabbed me and threw me down and then kind of, put a knee on my back and cuffed me. But it wasn't worse than a few bumps and bruises, scuffed elbows and whatnot. But there's a hilarious picture that came out of that. One of the cops in riot gear was a female, and the picture is of her grabbing me by the crotch as I'm on top of this wall flashing peace signs to the crowd. So it's been fun, to say the least. But recently, it's become quite disconcerting, I suppose. We've had evidence that the Department of Defense has been keeping track of our organization through what they call their Talon program, thanks to some documents released by the ACLU, and, of course, had a couple run-ins recently here in D.C., the capital of the police state.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the most recent revelations coming out of the undercover Maryland State Police. What were you doing? They say they were tracking potential terrorists. So first of all, what do we know about the extent of the surveillance? And then tell us something about what you were doing justified, according to them, that you be tracked.
Well, just so we're clear, I live in D.C., and I don't really do a whole lot of work in Maryland, but it's really interesting that you mentioned this, and I didn't quite make the connection until you brought it up, because what happened is that I was assaulted last Tuesday by an undercover FBI agent, and it just so happened that the plates on his unmarked vehicle were Maryland plates. But he said he was an FBI agent, so I'm not sure that there's a connection there. But if somehow Maryland is the source of this particular strain of activity coming out of our authoritarian masters and the police state these days, if there's some connection there, I wouldn't be particularly surprised.
You say he, an FBI agent, he was? He assaulted?
Yes.
Why did he assault you?
And just since we don't have time to get into the whole story here, let me just tell your listeners that I have actual video footage of this, and it's all available on my blog. If you go to Kokesh, kokesh.blogspot.com, I've got the video of myself and the guy that was with me, Bill Main, another member of Events for Peace, telling the whole story and the actual contact with the FBI agent when he grabbed me and pushed me up against his car. We've got that video footage up there. I've got video footage of a run-in I had with the cops the next day when one of the cops that detained me after that lied to me to my face, got it on tape. And also the police report that he wrote up that demonstrates or shows conclusively that the person in question here was an undercover FBI agent, and that what he did is he called in a 1033 or agent or officer in trouble that got the police response that occurred. But I was just walking down the street, and I was with Bill Main. He was driving me around. We had been we were picking up a piece of furniture, and then we were going to take down banners for the Revolution March, which I spoke at last weekend. And I saw this guy in this unmarked vehicle yelling at a guy in a red Celica to pull over and flashing his lights, the embedded lights, right, that you can't see when they're turned off. And I went around and started taking pictures because, you know, I understand that in D.C. we're experiencing just an incredible rise of the police state, and one of the ways that we can fight back is to document it and make sure that police know that they're being watched and being held accountable for their actions. And if we're just there with cameras, you know, if you see a cop on the street interacting with someone and you suspect that anything is amiss, or even if you don't, you know, hey, get out your cell phone camera, start taking pictures. It's not a matter of getting that cop in trouble necessarily, but we have the technology and the power as citizens now to hold our law enforcement accountable and make sure that they know that they are being watched and that they're not going to be able to get away with things that they've gotten away with in the past. So I started taking pictures of this guy and his vehicle, and I got up close to start taking a picture of his license plate, still staying back about 6 feet, and he ran out of the vehicle and flashed his gun. He was in civilian attire, flashed his gun on his right hip, and then at that point, you know, I threw my hands up like, all right, cool, dude. You know, if you want to go there, you know, I'm not going to resist. And he grabbed me by the arm and pulled me over to his vehicle. And at that point, my friend Bill Main was behind me, and he yells at him. Well, I can't repeat on the air what he yelled, but telling him to get away. And he went off and got his camera and went around the block and started taking pictures. So we have documentation of what happened after this. But he grabbed me and then he said, what are you doing? You're making me nervous. I said, good, I want you to be nervous. I want you to be nervous enough that you're not going to do anything that violates that gentleman's Fourth Amendment rights or any of his constitutional rights. And so he told me to go sit down, and then he got back in the car, and apparently he called the MPD and called in a 1033, which is really serious. And so literally a dozen MPD vehicles showed up, and I was walking around taking pictures, and you know, one of them then tried to stop me, and so I tried to walk away, and that's when he told me to put my hands up against the wall and push me up against it. We have pictures of all of this. I was cuffed. I had my wallet taken out of my pocket, and my sunglasses taken off, and I was detained there for a few minutes, and then this lieutenant came over and said, hey, what the heck is going on here, and straightened it out and let me go. But again, you know, just the kind of political harassment that we're experiencing is, I don't want to say unprecedented, but it's coming back in a very scary way. And the FBI agent told the police officers that he was tailing somebody and that this red Celica there got in the way of his tail and interfered with his ability to follow this person. And based on what we were told by that driver, we later hooked up with him. He's the one that recorded on his cell phone the video of the FBI agent grabbing me. Apparently, based on where we had turned and parked to go take down the signs and where this guy had interfered or been actually behind this undercover agent honking at him, it's highly likely that he was following us. Regardless, his behavior was incredibly inappropriate. If he thinks that, you know, his identity is not as valuable as pulling one person over and for erratic driving. That's what he wanted this guy charged with, and he tried to get the MPD guys to write him a citation for reckless driving, just for laying on the horn on him. But he couldn't do that without giving his name and his information and the MPD couldn't issue him a citation if they hadn't witnessed it personally. So the guy got off with nothing. And this guy risked blowing his cover because he lost his temper and wanted to go after this guy for making him lose his tail. And it makes sense because I'm not a high-priority target. If he's tailing me, he's probably pissed off that he's got that assignment in the first place, that he's got to follow around this petty professional dissident. And, you know, when someone gets in his way, he's going to be even more pissed off, and he's going to lose it. And that's what he did. And if he thinks that, you know, that kind of vindictive action is more important than his cover and more important than his job, more important than maintaining his undercover status, this guy needs to be exposed. He needs to be fired, and he needs to be held accountable. And if possible, I'm going to press charges for assault.
Well, apparently, I mean, they really are into this because the ACLU in Maryland released some 43 pages of summaries, computer logs. Some of them were forwarded as criminal acts. You guys were put into various computers. Adam, you were a former Marine, right?
That's correct. I served as a sergeant on a Marine Corps Civil Affairs team in Fallujah from February to September of 2004. I was in the reserves a total of 6.5 years at about 3 years of active duty time.
Why do you suppose they find you so dangerous and the people you're working with that they have this kind of elaborate tracking operation, surveillance operation? What do you think's going on?
Well, as you know, Naomi Wolf laid out in her book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, there are certain steps that governments go through to close down a society in what she calls a fascist shift. And part of that process is silencing dissent. And one of the 10 steps is targeting key individuals. And I'm honored that I'm considered by them to be a key individual in this sense. But it's a matter of suppression of dissent and scaring people. And we really have a duty to fight back to ensure that American democratic values and freedom of speech and expression and our right to speak out against our government's policies are preserved. And that's one of the things I'm trying to do now. And I was just so fortunate with this incident that this guy screwed with the wrong three people. He got me taking pictures. He got the guy that he pulled over, Eric Wexler, happened to be a lawyer who recorded the video footage. And my friend Bill Main, he's an Army veteran, very with the gentleman, started taking pictures right away as soon as he could sneak around the corner. So he screwed with the wrong three people. And we've got a chance here to fight back. And I think that, all in all, America is a self-righting ship. We may be lilting dangerously towards fascism right now. We may be going through that shift. But we have the ideals established in the Declaration that this country was founded on. We have the practical form of governance and the Constitution that is the embodiment of those ideals. It can be a guiding force to get us back to those. And I think we can use it to save this country right now. And that's what I'm fighting for. And so right now I'm fighting to hold police accountable in D.C. I've been doing a lot of work documenting illegal checkpoints. I've also got videos of that up on my blog. And in this point,
illegal checkpoints in Iraq or in the U.S.?
Well, it's ironic that you mention that because there is a striking similarity to the tactics of oppression used in Iraq and those used here. But literally on my block, just a couple weeks ago, there was
right here we're talking about
Washington, D.C., capital of the police state. And I'm not talking about the Trinidad neighborhood where there have recently been some shootings and checkpoints in reaction to that, which also happened to be illegal. I'm talking about a neighborhood where crime has been down lately, and cops are claiming that they have a shortage of manpower, and yet they are taking the time to set up what they call safety compliance checkpoints, which are inherently illegal violations of the Fourth Amendment.
So, finally, you've gone from a Marine intelligence in Fallujah to dealing with checkpoints and police brutality and the expansion of police power in your hometown of Washington, D.C. You have any regrets about the decision you made to leave the Marines and fight from the other side?
I don't think you can draw the lines that clearly in terms of making sides. I've always thought of myself on humanity's side, and it's just as I get more aware and more educated and learn how to be more effective in, you know, fighting for humanity and fighting for basic human rights and you know, in America, fighting for our civil liberties and fighting to further the Constitution and bring our country back to constitutional governance. There are people who you could say are on the other side in this, but I think what we're up against is the evil that is in every human's heart. You know, it's not a matter of good guys and bad guys all the time. What we need in America really is a cultural revolution, a revolution of values. The reason our government is corrupt is because our culture is corrupt, and we don't hold our elected officials accountable. So like in our discussion with impeachment with Conyers, you know, if we as citizens held our representatives accountable, they might be inclined to hold the president accountable. You know, but then if we were doing our duty as citizens, we wouldn't have Bush as a president in the first place. So I'm really trying to see this bigger picture and trying to see this greater struggle and find out where I can be most effective in the cause of liberty. And when I volunteered for the Marines, I thought that the Marine Corps was a force of good in the world and a force of peace, if more by our presence than by our actions. You know, give me that much. But the only thing that would have convinced me to not join the Marines and find a place where I could be more effective would have been a complete re-education of the last 50 years of American history. And of course, you know, the way our public schools are, the way our children are being dumbed down deliberately, you know, that's a very rare thing these days, that kind of awareness. And when I volunteered to go to Iraq, well, see, I was against the invasion. I was against the war before the war. But I thought that what we were doing afterwards was responsible foreign policy and genuinely trying to help the Iraqi people and rebuild. And so that's why I volunteered to go in civil affairs, and I was so excited to go in civil affairs. And the whole time I was there, I was acting in that spirit, even if I wasn't particularly effective in it. And that experience was really an enlightening experience for me. You know, I mean, people have asked me, well, what did you learn in Iraq? Well, the one lesson I took away was question everything, you know, and that needs to be an important part of that cultural revolution, is that we question authority, especially challenge our own assumptions. That's the only way we're ever going to progress as a society.
Well, we've been speaking with Adam Kokesh. He is among a number of people who apparently spied on extensively, according to documents released by the American Civil Liberties Union. They depict the pattern of infiltration of the activists in organizations between 2005-2006. Pages and pages of documents, computer logs. I guess this is what the national security state is doing post the Patriot Act. Thanks,
well, Adam. If I may, I want to put my last comment in context, please, because, you know, I said we're in the middle of a big step back right now. And in terms of the march of humanity and the bigger picture, it's a process of two steps forward and one step back. And just because we're in the middle of a big step back right now doesn't mean that it's not still a progress, a forward progress, this march of humanity. It's still a beautiful thing to be a part of this and to know that you can make a decision to fight for or against this. And I know that I'm fighting for it.
That is the voice of Adam Kokesh. He is on the board of the Iraq Vets Against the War. He works with Vets for Peace now, and he's constantly out there trying to resist the expansion of war. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me on.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music breaks this week: Battle Torn Pahalgam by Rahul Sharma, and When Johnny Comes Marching Home by Jim Page. I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.